Hey, Nate, what's up?
We're on the radio.
What? Like right now?
Yeah, it's on a promo from Live Sessions.
Oh, yeah, CFRC Live Sessions, Thursdays at 11 a.m.
Listen to sexy bands play live on air and hear exclusive interview highlights.
Sounds awesome. Tune in on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Lit. Okay, peace out, dude.
See you Thursday.
Hi, I'm Steve Swelzy Wells, and I'm extraordinarily excited to invite you to Gannspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th at the Royal Theatre in Gananoque. Come rock out with MC Shansky, Gananoque's poet laureate Gretchen Huntley, and listen and dance to some great rocking grooves by Pudge, The Red Handed, and my band Triple J, all in support of the Gananoque and Area Food Bank. Advance tickets are available now for $20 through Eventbrite, or by emailing me at ganspringrock@gmail.com. You can also help by buying one of our incredible Gan Rocks 2026 t-shirts and participating in our fundraising auction on Facebook, featuring wonderful gifts from local businesses, all in support of a great cause. So, take a look on Facebook for Gan Rocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, Iran calls the shots. We hear from American reporter Ahmad Hussam about what he saw during his wartime visit to Iran.
And all over the country, in every city, there are massive banners and posters and portraits of previously martyred people, whether they're civilians killed in an attack or generals who were killed and assassinated, or even the little girls who were just killed in Minab. So this is a society that understands that they have a very special kind of government born out of the revolution against U.S. imperialism and in opposition to Zionism.
Electronic Intifada contributor Rokaya Chamsuddin reports from Lebanon.
Israel has launched one of the most intense and geographically widespread waves of airstrikes on Lebanon in recent memory.
And on the resistance report, John Elmer breaks down Hezbollah's combat footage from the defense of South Lebanon.
Israel said they defeated Hezbollah. They clearly didn't. We're seeing Hezbollah fighting at a tempo of operations that we've never seen before in any of their previous wars, going all the way back to the 1980s.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on April 9th, 2026. Later in the show, filmmaker Ahmad Hussam is the founder of the media project Propaganda & Co. He recently traveled across Iran during the war and joins us to talk about it. But first, as Israel wreaks havoc on the humanitarian aid system, residents of tent camps in Gaza organize to distribute aid and solve daily problems. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Restoring Dignity to Gaza's Displaced by Khaled Al-Kashali, writing from Gaza. The Al-Horia 1 camp in Deir Balah, central Gaza, is located on a piece of sandy land with a few palm trees opposite the Al-Nakhil gas station. Before the genocide, this camp was just a few empty lots. The residents named the camp Al-Horia, Arabic for freedom, when they were first displaced here in October 2023. And then about 200 meters away is Al-Horia 2. The 150 or so tents in this camp, unlike official tents provided by aid organizations, appear improvised. They are tied together with ropes and covered by numerous layers of plastic sheeting to cover tears caused by the weather. Most of the approximately 300 to 450 people who live in this camp are women, and just like most displaced Palestinians in Gaza, they face a litany of problems, not least the lack of adequate food, medicines, and blankets. Khalaf Qasim Khalaf, 60, a retired public service worker whose home is near the camp, was one of the individuals who stepped in early on to try to find solutions for those who had evacuated to Deir Balah to escape Israeli violence. When people evacuated to Deir Balah, the committee was organized, Khalaf said. I took permission from the people who owned two empty lands near Al-Nakhil Street and then reached the people and helped them set up their tents. Khalaf, who is a father to seven, helped form a camp committee with those newly displaced in order to organize the distribution of aid and other basic tasks. We tried to provide as much help as we could to the displaced people, but mostly our work was in connecting them with aid organizations, Khalaf said. The committee would collect information from the families displaced in the camp, like their full names, ID numbers, and the number of family members, and they would coordinate with aid organizations to provide food and supplies. Every time we distributed aid in the camp, the number of aid packages was not enough, Khalaf said. Yet, without the assistance of the committee, the camp residents were experiencing such hardship that they would not have been able to advocate for themselves in obtaining aid. As of March 2026, an estimated 700,000 Palestinians are displaced in Gaza, many of them living under conditions of precarity and dehumanization, according to the UN Human Rights Office. For those living in tent camps or other shelters, such as schools, throughout Gaza, informal camp committees have become a way to organize needs and coordinate with humanitarian organizations to receive aid. Such organization among camp residents is crucial, as aid agencies are thinly stretched and operate throughout the strip with limited resources. At Al-Huriya 1, the residents faced a difficult time when winter came and their camp flooded. Young people in the camp organized and built channels to drain the water, according to Khalaf. If a tent collapsed, they would help set it up again, and they would even help us in distributing food, he said. They would carry sand from the beach back to the camp to help absorb all the water on the ground. Women in the camp also organized to look after children and to provide what education they could, given the widespread Israeli destruction of schools. Still, the problems in the camp are never ending, and malnutrition is among the main concerns. Those are excerpts from Restoring Dignity to Gaza's Displaced by Khaled Al-Kershali, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Coming up, John Elmer reports on the latest Hezbollah battle videos. But before we get to that, Rokaya Chamsedin is a southern Lebanese researcher and reporter. She filed this report for us on April 8th, 2026.
I'm reporting for the Electronic Intifada from Lebanon, where Israel has launched one of the most intense and geographically widespread waves of airstrikes on Lebanon in recent memory, hitting Beirut, southern Lebanon, and the Bekaa Valley in a coordinated escalation that began before dawn. In Beirut, multiple strikes were reported across the southern outskirts of the capital, with explosions tearing through densely populated neighborhoods like Barbour, Khalde, Bir Hassan, and Ain Mreisi, among many others. Residential buildings were damaged or destroyed, fires broke out, and civilians were forced to flee into the streets as the bombardment intensified. The scale of the strikes in and around the capital marks a significant escalation compared to recent days. Across southern Lebanon, the attacks have been described by local sources as nearly nonstop. Dozens of towns and villages, like Kleile, Adam Salim, and others, have been hit in repeated waves, with airstrikes targeting a wide range of locations. Entire residential blocks have been reduced to rubble in some areas, while roads and essential infrastructure have also been struck, complicating rescue efforts and access for emergency services. In the Bekaa Valley, Israeli warplanes expanded the scope of the campaign deeper into Lebanon, conducting massacres, including an airstrike that targeted a funeral procession for a martyr killed during a previous Israeli attack. Casualty figures are still emerging, but early estimates point to a growing toll. Lebanon's Ministry of Health has confirmed multiple deaths, including at least 8 people killed in a pre-dawn strike on a cafe in Saida, with dozens more wounded. And across Beirut, the casualty toll is estimated to be in the hundreds. Officials caution that the number of casualties is expected to rise as rescue teams continue to search through debris in heavily affected areas. The scale, intensity, and the reach of these Israeli airstrikes have raised serious concerns about further escalation. With attacks hitting urban centers as well as rural neighborhoods, the humanitarian situation is rapidly worsening as hospitals struggle to cope. As the situation continues to unfold, the full extent of the damage and loss caused by these Israeli attacks is still coming into view, with many areas yet to be fully assessed.
That was the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Rokaya Chamsedine, in Lebanon. This week on the Resistance Report, John Elmer breaks down Hezbollah's combat footage from the defense of South Lebanon.
This is the Resistance Report for day 916. We're going to look at Hezbollah right now because Hezbollah has been fighting a fierce battle against Israel's suggested attempts that they were going to take all of South Lebanon up to the Litani River. Israel changed their mind this week that that's no longer the goal. The goal is now simply a 3-kilometer buffer zone around the border to push fire up. And as Rokaya Chamsedine reported for us on the massacres of civilians that happened, large wave of Israeli airstrikes against Hezbollah in Lebanon using 50 fighter jets dropped 160 bombs on 100 targets within 10 minutes. However, the Air Force, they bragged about it even more. They said it was 60 seconds, their intention to carry out that heinous massacre in 60 seconds. And they called it eternal darkness was the way they named their operation. So again, another revealing Israeli sadism, I guess you could say. So there's 5 Israeli divisions that are fighting spread across from Nakura, Bint Jbeil, and then up the Galilee Panhandle over to Merjayun and Qiyam. Those places virtually touch the Litani River. So Israeli forces are attempting to push forward for a few kilometers, take a picture on the Litani River and say they achieved their military goals. But really, this week during an IDF briefing, they claimed that they're no longer trying to disarm Hezbollah, which they said they already did, if people remember back for the last 2 years. They said they won that war because they blew up a bunch of people's hands with pagers in a mass terror attack, and they assassinated senior leadership. So they believed that they had won the war. But that was not the case, because in 2024, the 60-day invasion of South Lebanon failed. Israel didn't invade Lebanon. They were unsuccessful. And what they did achieve in Lebanon was to put 5 advanced military posts inside Lebanon. But they did that under the cover of the ceasefire, as Israel is wont to do for these things, violating the ceasefire in its fundamental way. This is where the engagements, face-to-face fighting has happened from Nakura on the west coast to Bint Jbeil, and then in the Merjayun area, and then Qiyam, where they're facing ground forces that are repelling Israeli operations. We can take a look at one of those operations here. This is in Tebe in the Merjayun area. And you can see a tank here that is withdrawing. Israeli newspaper clippings talked about this operation because this was Israeli soldiers fleeing. A report from Mako News that says the vehicles were left behind. They left 3 excavators behind during a panicked withdrawal, a panicked retreat. Information received by Mako Agency indicates that during the attack launched by forces in South Lebanon, which included deep penetration into hostile territory using heavy engineering means, heavy fire was opened on the forces using mortars, high altitude rockets, and precision missiles. The incident did not end at this point. Shortly after the panicked retreat, Hezbollah fighters came down and encircled the area in case the troops came back to get their excavators, front end loaders that they had left, that they're trying to change the geography of the land in South Lebanon to make it a little easier for them. Here is how Hezbollah dealt with that. Launching here 122-millimeter Grad rockets, Katushas, as they call them in Lebanon. They're actually Iranian rockets. They're not Grads. All of these weapons are Iranians, built by an indigenous Iranian weapons industry, and many of them are built by Hezbollah, the drones and the guidance systems that are added onto rockets to make them precision-guided missiles. That is all done by Hezbollah. But you can see here, they're pounding them at the site with rocket fire. And rocket fire underpins all of these operations. It's been the thing that they've done the most. Upwards of 7,000 rockets and missiles have been fired during this part of the war. This is the field report, because Hezbollah puts out these field reports every day. We log them and track them, and it's how we can, on this program, connect the dots and count the operations and understand what's going on in the battlefield, because their command and control is perfectly intact. They're filing these field reports immediately. They're not delayed. They clearly have communication. Now we're watching them walk through what looks like an abandoned campground, but it's where Israeli forces were setting up Yahalom tunnel units. Apparently, one soldier was killed and five were wounded in the artillery and rocket attacks, and they were ambushed in this site and fled. And you can see their shoes left behind. And the soldier that was killed was a lone soldier, a foreign fighter from New Jersey who didn't live in Israel, didn't have any connection to Israel, but wanted to go and fight in Israel's army. And he was killed in this operation, one of at least 13 the Israelis have admitted to. Don't feel super confident that that's an accurate number. The Israelis and the Americans have been very tight-lipped about the information front in this war. There you were looking at the excavators there left behind. That one looks like it had been hit. It's got broken glass, but you can see these are the excavators that we saw in Gaza as well. Caterpillar always supporting Israeli apartheid and criminal aggressions. The military media department in Hezbollah has given the fighters cameras in a way that they didn't in the previous war. These are not official cameramen or, as we can see, skilled cameramen, but they are recording their operations. And we're seeing things because of that that we never saw in the first battle in 2023 and 2024. Hezbollah was very secretive about the operations, about the tools that they were using, and now we're getting to see a lot more in these recent videos. What Hezbollah is doing is hitting Israeli military positions, troop movements, makeshift bases. Anywhere the Israelis move to, they're being shelled from across the border all the way along. More than 6,500, upwards of 7,000 rockets have been fired, and they're aiming at troops all along the borders. And it's been the underpinning of this operation, which has been using all different types of weapons, but they're just being pounded. This has been critical to Hezbollah's operations. Let's take a look at this next video. Here's fighters. The first fighter says that we're going to show you the outside now. He's talking to the Fadi launcher here. This is a Fadi rocket launcher that is in a hardened shelter, truck mounted. And you can see that he is smashing out the cinder block walls of the hardened shelter. And that's what the other Hezb fighter says. He says, let's show the Fadi the outside, because it's been hiding in here all this time. And there's the truck in pretty rough shape, but it gets the job done. But you can see there from a hardened shelter. Now we're going to watch the fighters wire it up. We can see them with their control panels. These are all things that were previously never shown in Hezbollah operations. So we're seeing a lot. Previously, we would just see the launch, or we might see the fighters. There you see the fighters give the victory sign before launching. And this fighter who's got the camera, he says, this is my first time with the camera, so if I flinch, don't judge me. As the Fadi launches, it makes a significant noise. There's another victory sign from the fighters. So we're really seeing the fighters for the first time, rather than being behind the fighters that we saw in the first war. There's the launch, and the cameraman didn't flinch, so good on him for that. But it's important to note that Hezbollah were the founders of this military media. They did it going back to beta and VHS tapes that they would deliver to television stations that would show it to prove their operations against the Israelis, because the Israelis just lie. The next one, we're going to see the multiple launch rocket system. And this is what's really, again, we're seeing them in the truck on their way to the site. This is a dangerous operation. But one thing that we learned from the Israelis, and one of the reasons why the Israelis don't think that they can take the area all the way up to the Litani, well, they can't because of the fighters, but also they can't do it. They would take heavy losses. And also, they've realized that the rockets aren't fired from south of the Litani, particularly these larger multiple launch. They can be fired from behind the Litani River. And many of the heavier missiles and rockets that they have 200 plus kilometer range. So the Litani River isn't any kind of a border. Previously, when they only fired Katyusha rockets, it was somewhat useful because of the range of the Katyushas, but that's a bygone era. Again, we see in this video the fighters all around the launcher. We see what the circumstances is around the fighters. This is a dangerous moment for them. They've got a Hezbollah flag hanging off the launcher. They're communicating with each other about the launch. Israel says that Hezbollah has between 8,000 and 10,000 missiles left. This is compared to 40,000 that they had before October 7th. But we know that before October 7th, Israel said that number was in the many hundreds of thousands. So there's a lot of revisionist history going on here because Israel said they defeated Hezbollah. They clearly didn't. We're seeing Hezbollah fighting at a tempo of operations that we've never seen before in any of their previous wars, going all the way back to the 1980s. The number of operations in the last 2 days before the war, there was 160 operations. Here again, you can see them pulling up the truck for another multiple launch. And it's just very interesting to see these details from the commanders. And this fighter is addressing the camera, saying that they will not leave the battlefield. Significant developments on the rocket and missile front here by Hezbollah. Let's take a look at the next one. We're going to watch them set up here World War II era field guns that we have never seen before. Didn't know they had, but this is for the defense of Bintij Baal. They said that there are Israeli soldiers mustering into the south of the town. And so you can see the fighters here. They're talking about amongst each other, talking about recording this part. Is it okay to record this part? He's like, yeah, it's fine to record it. And you see them setting it up. You see the cameraman there again. And these are firing off very rare weapons that I don't think many people expected to see. This is a KS-19 100 millimeter anti-aircraft gun that's being loaded up here and being used as an anti-personnel weapon to fire on those troops that are down in this southern area of Bintij Baal. If this war continues, Bintij Baal will be a major battleground, strategic location, a long history of resistance in Bintij Baal. The 2006 war essentially died in Bintij Baal because of the resistance there. So the fight for Bintij Baal will be significant. There again, the fighter with the victory signs, we see a little bit of their personality. We see the details that go into covering this. We're watching a fighter here remove the netting that covers the weapon in the forest. They're deep inside the forest here, setting up these guns. The second one is 122 millimeter towed howitzer. So a full-on World War II era field gun. These kind of guns, should they have enough ammunition for them, will definitely slow the advance of the Israelis. Although for Hezbollah's fighting doctrine, they're not treating the Israelis entering the town of Bintij Baal as the defeat. They're not fighting for a single rock. Nasrallah said it many times before that our fighters are more valuable than a piece of stone. So they're not going to hold some arbitrary line. They're going to encircle and fight a guerrilla warfare that doesn't allow the Israelis to take control of the city. And when they are in the city, they will be hit regularly. And you can watch this be fired out of the bush. And it's pretty remarkable bush that you see there. This is the nature of the fight in South Lebanon and part of the significant advantage that Hezbollah has on this territory. Let's take a look at the next one because we are seeing here the underground missile bases of the Hezbollah fighters. We're watching here a flashlight fighter walking down into a tunnel apparatus. He chose one direction, but it looked like he could have gone two directions, suggesting that these missile silos, these missile bases are significant. They're not single rail, but here they're now walking in this cave, in this tunnel, and you're going to see the rail launcher here for the Qadr precision-guided ballistic missile. But you can see the single rail there. So this is being launched from underground on a single rail. You saw at each of the turns when he decided to go left or right, you could see a blast door at each of those turns. And that's how you know it's a fully functioning missile silo, because those blast doors have to be blocked at all times for the launch. And it's why the Israelis can't defeat the missile silos in Iran. We're going to find that in this 2 week period of time, Iran is going to dig out their buried silos insofar as they were hit. They can simply be dug out. And here's Hezbollah showing the locations of these missiles because they were high-value targets. They targeted the Hakiria IDF's headquarters and Amman, their military intelligence barracks. This operation was March 26th. We're getting these videos about a week delayed, about a week after the operations, we're getting them. And you can see even just from week to week, the improvements in targeting and the tempo of it, the number, just the straight number of operations. And the second 622 millimeter Qadr II that carries a 400 kilogram warhead is aimed at the Human Shields base, IDF base, in Tel Aviv. The Hakiria, the campus, is the headquarters of the IDF in Tel Aviv and is completely surrounded by civilians. It's an old base, but it's been modernized, and they embrace the fact that it has human shields in downtown Tel Aviv, using rocket as cover fire, keeping troops behind the lines under fire. The anti-tank ops are the first level of defense of the territory in South Lebanon. This is from the first month of the war. So this goes to April 1st. From March 2nd, 136 Israeli tanks had been targeted, along with 25 other vehicles, bulldozers, Humvees we've seen be hit. The anchor of these operations, of course, are these Almaz attacks, these cloned Israeli spike systems. And this here is the longest we've seen of the setup of the Almaz anti-tank guided missile launcher here. You can see the fighters setting it up. And again, this is just a totally different view than we had seen of them before. We might have gotten just the front half of that in previous videos, but now we see the way that the team works together. These are hunter-killer teams, tank-killer teams, firing these top-attack anti-tank guided missiles that come, as the name suggests, from above, which is partially designed to evade countermeasures, active protection systems from the Israeli military. But here we're going to see him put it right through the hatch of that Merkava tank there. This operation was in Al Baida, so right near where the troops fled from earlier on. And then one last Hezbollah video, because I think this one really wraps up how Hezbollah feels. You're looking at Fatah 110, possibly a Fatah 360 short-range ballistic missile. And you see they're affixing a sticker. There you see Naim Qasem, Nasrallah, and the Virgin Mary. There's Musa Sadr, Imam Musa Sadr there. And then on the missile is a sticker that says, it's for the people of South Lebanon. And the message says, "You will return to your homes with your heads held high, O honorable people of the South." And then it says on the missile launcher, it says the classic Qassam line, "It was not you who threw, but God when you threw." So they had that on the missile launcher there. And these are very effective short-range ballistic missiles that are the same short-range ballistic missiles that Iran is firing at the Gulf. And so these are doing damage, and these are targeting Israeli military bases and installations, which we get no coverage of whatsoever. The bases that are outside of the city, we're not hearing anything about casualties, about hits. It's all being kept secret. And just on the final note, let's turn to Gaza. Abu Obeida, the new Abu Obeida, who replaced Hudayfa al-Khalut, who was assassinated during the war. Abu Obeida gave a speech the other day saying that, "We emphasize that what the enemy failed to take from us with tanks and genocide will not be taken from us through politics and negotiations." He blessed the people of Gaza for their steadfastness and sacrifice. He said, "After a war of genocide and ethnic cleansing and some of the most horrific massacres in modern history, the aggression continues to expand, spreading across the region. Israel launched a treacherous aggression against Iran in the most deceptive negotiations in full coordination with the United States. The true nature of the Zionist entity has been exposed, revealing its weakness and total dependence on external support for help, for it will not last. Amid global silence and double standard, the world demands concessions only from the Palestinians while ignoring the occupation's violations and refusal to honor agreements. The occupation continues targeting civilians to create chaos, turning safe zones into death traps, restricting aid and movement." He also says that, "We received with great pride the message from the Islamic Republic addressed to our people through the spokesperson, Ibrahim Zulfagari, dedicating operations, putting them on missiles to our fallen leaders, such as Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and Yahya Sinwar. The actions of the fighters in Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen are extensions of the Al-Aqsa flood, punishing those responsible for those war crimes. We declare full support for Lebanon, its people, and its resistance, and renew our call for the fighters of the Lebanese resistance to turn direct confrontation into a real opportunity to capture U.S. soldiers. And he ends by saying, once again, we emphasize that what the enemy failed to take from us with tanks and genocide will not be taken from us with politics and negotiations. Qassam is not disarming. That is the resistance report for week 6 of the Iran war and day 916 of the genocide in Gaza.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. We now turn our attention to Iran. The Electronic Intifada's director, Ali Abunima, sets the stage for our next guest.
For 40 days, the United States and Israel relentlessly bombed Iran, killing and injuring thousands of people, targeting residential neighborhoods, and bragging about destroying civilian targets, including industry and infrastructure. The World Health Organization has verified attacks on at least 20 medical facilities, resulting in at least 9 deaths. In some of the more recent attacks, U.S. and or Israeli warplanes attacked the Pasteur Institute, a renowned research facility, Dalaram Sina Psychiatric Hospital, and the Tawfiq Daru Pharmaceutical Factory. U.S. President Donald Trump promised even worse, threatening to destroy Iran's whole civilization. Trump's genocidal hatred and ignorance about Iran and its people reflects the decades-long effort to demonize the country by U.S. leaders and media. Rarely are we permitted to hear directly from Iranians or to see the country through the eyes of international reporters who do not echo imperialist anti-Iran agendas. But one independent reporter who did travel to Iran recently is Ahmed Hossam. He is a filmmaker and founder of the media project Propaganda & Co. Ahmed, we're so pleased to welcome you to the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you, Ali, and thank you, Nora, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ahmed, you were just in Iran. You left just a few days ago, and you've already published a documentary that you've called Iran at War about your trip, or at least the first 2 episodes, and people can find them at the Propaganda & Co. YouTube channel. And I want to start with a short clip from the first episode.
Visit was to a civilian apartment building that was hit by a bomb in the middle of the night. This woman survived the attack. Her husband and 2 children, ages 3 and 13, however, did not.
Said, please don't move these rubble. My children are inside. And but you, they told me, no, we have care, we have taken them out.
And you can see them.
And the rubble was on my children. Then I told the aid worker, the ambulance, that until they take my sons out, I cannot leave this place. Then they told me that we can keep them safe, but they were dead.
So, Ahmed, tell us where this happened and what can you tell us about what happened to this woman and her family, and what was it like coming face to face with the human reality of this war that so many of us only experienced from a distance?
So this was in the northwestern city of Tabriz in the northwestern region of Iran, which is in the Azerbaijani region. For people who aren't aware, there are millions of Azeri people or Azerbaijani people living in Iran. This woman, she was actually speaking Azeri. She wasn't speaking Farsi. And I think that's an important fact to point out because her first language is Azeri. Sometimes these people in the region can speak Farsi as a second language. Some people can't even speak it at all. And the reason why I think that's important to mention is because the United States and Western media and their propaganda, they've tried to present Iran as a country that is loosely held together by an oppressive regime, and that there are many ethnicities and minorities that are ready to rise up and overthrow the governments. But of course, that isn't actually the case. Many of these people, including this woman, are of different ethnicities and they speak different languages, and they see themselves as part of the fabric of Iran, and they're proud to be part of Iran. This woman, unfortunately, her home was bombed, and till this day, we aren't really sure why. We spoke to her and some Red Crescent first responders that helped pull her and her family or what was left of them, unfortunately, out of the rubble. And they could not provide any explanation. This was a lower middle class by Iranian standards, civilian neighborhood. There was no military target nearby. There was no base nearby. There was no air defense in the area. And so no one can really explain how this happened. But she was just an innocent woman, a mother of two, and her husband was the local barber in the area. And in the middle of the night, close to the early morning prayers around 5 a.m, a bomb was dropped on her home, and it just completely destroyed the home. And she watched her dead children being pulled out of the rubble. And she was just so devastated by that. And for me, this was my first time in a war zone. Shortly after this, I had interviewed my colleagues, Dimitri Lascaris and Tim Anderson, who are journalists who accompanied me on the trip. And I asked them, like, how do you feel about harvesting a woman's story like this? Because for me, obviously, like, I'd benefit just by being, like, I'm being interviewed today. I'm being platformed by you because I went to Iran. But that woman is still back there in Iran. You know, she lost her children. And so being mindful of the fact that I guess my career benefits from going on such a journey, harvesting her story, obviously it's difficult. But what I try to do is just do her story justice and try to amplify her experience and provide her a platform to kind of share her thoughts, which she did shortly afterwards. You know, I asked her, what message do you have for the American people? And I think it was really powerful and inspirational the way that she responded, because I think any one of us, if we had lost our family members, and then just within a couple of hours, you asked me what I think, and I would just demand revenge, and I would call for all kinds of, you know, unspeakable violence on those who hurt me and oppressed me and took my family from my life. From this world. But she responded differently. She had the strength to control her anger and her outrage and say, I don't have any problem with the American people. And, you know, her problem is just with the administration that is waging this war against the people of Iran, against innocent people like her. And I thought that was a powerful, inspirational message. And it's something I wanted to share with people, especially as an American citizen. Outside of the CNN journalist who went to Iran, no one else from Western media has gone. And so I took it upon myself to go and try and tell their stories. And yeah, it was a powerful and emotional experience.
That story in particular, that's been the story that Palestinians in Gaza have been repeating over and over again for the last 2.5 years of this genocide. It's what Palestinians in Palestine and people in Lebanon have been saying for decades and decades and decades. It's this U.S.-Israeli modus operandi of just devastation, destruction, killing, massacring families, and the targets are children. Let's look at another clip that you made, and then I'll ask you a question about that one as well.
Despite being up against both Israel and the United States, which is the world's greatest superpower in human history, millions of Iranians take to the streets every night to express their defiance. They don't want a ceasefire. They don't want to back down. They want revenge. They want justice. They want dignity. They want honor. They want to make history. And they may have potentially already done it.
Talk about the atmosphere in Iran, both in terms of ordinary daily life and at some of these rallies you attended, what people were saying, how it felt to be there. And what do you mean when you say that the Iranian people have already made history?
Firstly, there are two things that are true here. One is that the U.S. and Israel have committed unspeakable atrocities and have dropped over, at this point, 20,000 bombs. At the same time, however, life in Iran is completely normal. And that's because of the fact that this is a highly developed society, despite the fact that they've been under sanctions for 40 plus years. And it's a massive, massive country. If you took the map of Iran and superimposed it on Western Europe, you would find that it's just as big, if not bigger. So you would need millions of bombs, you know, to completely destroy all of the infrastructure. So it's difficult to produce the Gazification, if you will, of Iran because of the sheer size of it. The cities are gigantic. It's a country of over 90 million people. And so for me, while I was in Iran, it was difficult to see any destruction. You have to go looking for it. Like that woman's house in Tabriz, you would only see that if you went driving through the neighborhood looking for it. And so most of Iran is still intact, despite the fact that there have been tens of thousands of bombs dropped on them, their civilians, and their infrastructure. And so I don't want to make it sound like they aren't taking significant damage. They are. And the intention is to destroy their society and break them apart. But at the same time, this is a country that is still operating as if there's nothing going on. When I was there, I felt like if these people wanted, they really could fight for years because there's no disruption to their transportation. There's no disruption to their food, to their medicine, to their energy. Even when Trump threatened to destroy their power plants, you know, it later came out that Iran has one of the most decentralized power grids in the entire world. Like, you would have to bomb every single power station in the country to knock out the country's power. And so life is continuing as normal, and there's a lot of morale. People are very dedicated to the revolution. One of the people we interviewed was about an hour outside of Tabriz. So this is still in the Azerbaijani region of northwestern Iran. And he was an Azeri man, and his son was killed in an attack on the post office. And when we spoke to him, the first thing he said was, "I pay my respects to the leader of the Islamic Revolution. And my greatest honor and my greatest pride is that my son was just martyred." So the Iranian people, the concept of martyrdom is huge in Islam. Whether you're Sunni or Shia, we see it in Gaza, the resistance fighters and the families of innocent civilians who've been killed, they all pride themselves on being martyrs. And in Shia Islam, I think it's taken a bit further than that. And in Iran, they pride themselves on this concept of martyrdom. And you see it plastered all over the city and all over the country. In every city, there are massive banners and posters and portraits of previously martyred people, whether they're civilians killed in an attack or they are engineers committed to the missile program or generals who were killed and assassinated. It doesn't matter if it took place during the Iran-Iraq war many decades ago or last summer during the 12-day war, or even the little girls who were just killed in Minab at the start of the war. You see their images everywhere, both new and old. You see it in the mosques as well. So this is a society that understands that they have a very special kind of government born out of the revolution against U.S. imperialism and in opposition to Zionism. And they pride themselves for that. Tell me what country on earth has withstood a direct U.S. assault for 30 plus days. I can't think of any in recent memory. And I don't mean to compare Iran to other countries. Obviously, there's a lot of different factors like military capabilities. Obviously, geography plays an important role. I bet if Venezuela had some kind of pressure point or choke point like the Strait of Hormuz, you know, potentially maybe it would have been different with Maduro, who knows? So Iran is blessed by the geography and the conditions that they have. But at the same time, though, I think we have to give credit to the people who've dedicated themselves to protecting the revolution and building up their capabilities. I went to the Aerospace Museum last summer and I saw firsthand the engineering on display. I saw there are many different versions of their ballistic missiles. I saw they preserve the history and they pride themselves on the history. They give you a whole story of how the missile program was born, how it was advanced, who the key players were, and how they dedicated their lives. And you see that, you see their drone technology. And so it was all just very impressive. And I think all of that history over the last 40 years is why Iran was able to not only withstand a U.S. direct assault for over 30 days, which was incredibly intense and is still technically ongoing, but they did not just withstand this pressure, but they actually had the U.S. almost call uncle. I mean, the Strait of Hormuz applied a lot of pressure on the global economy, and you could just tell by Trump's rhetoric that he was going kind of insane. Every day he was contradicting himself and saying the most outrageous things and making all these threats and then being called out on his bluff by people that are unfazed. And I saw this with my own two eyes, you know, speaking to people. I was in Isfahan and we were in this famous square called Nakhchivan. And while we were in the square, they bombed just outside of it. And I was scared because it was the first time I heard a bomb and saw the smoke rising while I was outside. Usually it was happening like while I was in the hotel, right? But I actually saw this and I became scared. I'm not going to lie. You know, I was nervous, but I looked around and everyone was cool, calm, and collected. And I started interviewing little kids. And, you know, when I saw their bravery and how calm and cool they were, then I became calm. And so I think they're a special people with a special history that have done something historic. And I think Donald Trump was not expecting that.
Just talk about those nightly rallies. We who have not been to Iran have seen them on social media. You were there. You were in Tabriz. You were in Tehran. You were in Isfahan. You went to Bandar Abbas, I believe. Did you see these in every city you went to?
Yeah, every city you go to, they have these rallies, and they have them in multiple spots all over the city. Instead of one large, massive central rally that can be difficult to get to, blocks traffic, et cetera, they made it as convenient as possible, and they set up different nodes all around the city. And these are centers that have a stage, they have lighting, they have a speaker system, they're playing footage of like missile attacks on the projectors, they're playing music, giving speeches, listening to poetry, they're giving out snacks, tea, dessert. They have families of the martyrs there, and people come pay their respects to them. People donate to them. People listen to them speak. They interview them. And there are people who attend this rally on foot. They bring their families. They bring their children. There are people who just simply drive by and honk their horns. And it's impressive because they have been doing this every single night. And of course, as you would imagine, after a couple of nights, it gets kind of old and redundant. And so, you know, the numbers dwindle, but then, you know, you have major flare-ups and moments, and then people come out again. But for the most part, consistently, people are coming out every single night to protect the nation, to protect the revolution, to have morale and encourage one another. And it's so much fun. You know, you see these viral social media videos where you have young women who are making these cool, flashy, like reels and TikToks, and it's just impressive, you know, like it's something that brings a lot of pride, I think, right? And you feel that all around the region. There are a lot of Muslims. We all know, obviously, unfortunately, there's this plague of sectarianism where there's like anti-Sunni or anti-Shia rhetoric on both sides. But many Sunnis, I think, came around and wanted to show support for Iran, because I think it was one of the few instances throughout this genocidal experience over the last couple of years that brought our people in a regional-wide, civilizational-wide level pride, because finally someone is standing up and they're doing a pretty good job. And Iran, these people in there get to actually wave the flag as a proud Iranian doing that. And it was incredible to witness. And it's just, I think, a testament to the Iranian people and the way they've organized themselves and the way they've banded together in this situation.
You mentioned the Strait of Hormuz, and that is, of course, the crucial waterway through which a fifth of the world's energy supply has to pass. And it passes entirely through Iranian and Omani territorial waters. And Iran exercises control over it. For decades, Iran allowed free passage through the Strait of Hormuz. But after it was attacked, it began asserting its sovereignty there and its power there. You actually got to visit the Strait. You posted a couple of clips on Twitter X. And this one, the first one, we'll watch too. The first one you posted with the caption, "The only American in the Strait of Hormuz." So let's take a look at you, the only American in the Strait of Hormuz.
You can go, you can't go, you can go, you can't go. Pay up, buddy, pay up. What's that? Oh, the money didn't go through. You gotta wait.
The journalists Dimitri Lascaris, Tim Anderson, and myself had the unique opportunity to sail through the Strait of Hormuz off the coast of Bandar Abbas in Iran in order to witness what can only be described as a historical inversion of the economic world order, as oil tanker after oil tanker after oil tanker is forced to pay transit fees in the Chinese yuan currency to the Iran government in order to obtain permission to pass through the Strait of Hormuz and on towards their destination.
I was just going to ask about your visit to Tehran, the capital. It was not your first visit there. You've been there before. Let's watch a short clip of your travels around Tehran.
First stop in Tehran was Arak Square in Old Tehran, where the famous Grand Bazaar and Golestan Palace is located. This is normally a thriving and energetic environment, but it was a ghost town. Upon our arrival, the first thing we noticed was the massive destruction done to the judicial building. Whatever hit this building tore through at least four different floors and put the building completely out of service. But the damage, unfortunately, wasn't just done to this building. The shrapnel and shockwaves significantly damaged the Takht-i-Marmar marble throne room at Golestan Palace, nearly 500 feet away. Golestan Palace is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and the Takht-i-Marmar is an epic marble throne built in 1805 by Fateh Ali Shah of the Qajar dynasty.
That's their other targets also, is destroying antiquities, is trying to erase culture and history and tradition, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's Jerusalem, whether it's South Lebanon, or whether it's Iran. What was it like being in the capital amidst these just horrific bombings and deliberate destruction of holy sites of deep-rooted culture?
So when I went to Iran a year ago, like 2 or 3 weeks before the 12-day war, the thing that I and many others notice, and it's impossible not to observe when you go to Tehran, is how bad the traffic is. It's one of the most populated cities, I think, if not the most populated city in the entire Middle East. There are so many people living there. And it's become such a problem that the government has flirted with the idea of moving the capital and trying to incentivize people to leave because the traffic is terrible. It's like, it's worse than LA. You know, a 10-minute drive is easily an hour and a half. There's so much pollution because of that from the cars. But I arrived on the first day of Eid. It was also the first day of Nowruz, which is like a rare celestial like alignment of the calendar. And then the third thing, obviously, was the war. So I describe it in the video as a double whammy. It's actually a triple whammy. And so you have people leaving the city because of the war for safety. You have people leaving the city for Nowruz, and then people staying indoors because of the Eid holiday. So when I got there, the streets were empty. We were the only car on the road for several miles. And that was eerie because this is, like, compared to last time, the most populated, busiest place I'd ever been. And now it's completely empty and it's a ghost town. And actually, I went to this area where the judicial building was bombed and the palace area. And that is also a very vibrant area, very busy. There's a ton of traffic, walking traffic, and there was just nobody there. Now, it's changed since, obviously, because the Eid holiday and Nowruz holiday has come to an end. But it was still unusual to see, and it was eerie. You saw the destruction done to the judicial building. There are many buildings like that in Tehran that unfortunately have been destroyed. And as you said, you know, it wasn't the only cultural heritage site damaged in the process. Like when I put out my next video about Isfahan, Shiraz, you'll see like all over Iran, cultural sites are either directly hit or there's a major attack next to it, adjacent to it. They try to describe these places as like military targets, but these are civilian government buildings, and they are oftentimes adjacent to these historical sites because it's just, that's how much of their architecture is constructed. Like, for example, in Isfahan with the famous Nakhchivan Square, this was built by previous dynasties that deliberately merged mosques and bazaars and government buildings. So it was a fusion of culture and religion and governance into a central location. And that's why in Tehran, you have the judicial building next to the Grand Bazaar and the palace. That's why in Isfahan, it's the same. In Shiraz, it's the same. And in all these places, the United States and Israel bombed it. And it's a big FU to the Iranian people. And it's saying, like, this is not just an attack on the military or the IRGC. It's an attack on Iranian people, on Persian history and civilization. They want society to crumble from within, and they're trying to rapidly produce that. I also went to a sports complex. I mean, this was a gigantic sports complex where people could wrestle, learn judo, jujitsu, play volleyball, play basketball. They could play soccer or football, however you want to call it. And it was a place for thousands of kids, both boys and girls, from the city to go play and stay busy every single day. And they annihilated it. Like, they didn't attack near it or hit it one time. They gave it three Tomahawk missiles and completely obliterated it. It's gone, and it's not coming back anytime soon. And we interviewed a kid right outside the gate, and now he has nothing to do, him and his little brother. And there are thousands of other children like that. And in my first episode, I covered destruction of a waste management facility. So it begs the question, why? Why are you hitting cultural sites, the judicial building, soccer fields, pharmacies, parks, waste management facilities? It's because they want to annihilate the society the way they did to Gaza. They want to just force the people out onto the streets against their own government because of so much frustration and tension and the fact that there's just simply nothing better to do. And when you think about kids, like, what do kids do without school or sports or something to guide their energy? They often resort to vandalism or drugs or something like that. And so it's sick when you zoom out and understand that all of this is just because Israel believes in their own supremacy and they want to have dominance over other people in the region. And if they don't get it, this is the kind of damage that they'll do.
Just give us some thoughts about you know, this wasn't your first visit. You had been last year. But thinking about that first visit and this visit during the war, what surprised you most about traveling to Iran? And, you know, what do you hope people will take away from the work you're doing and the explainer videos you're making after this trip? What's the one thing you'd want global audiences, Americans in particular, to know?
I want American people to empathize with the Iranian people. I want them to understand that they're normal people living in a beautiful country with a lot of history. That would be a wonderful place for them to visit as tourists, to visit in peace. I got to go to the Strait of Hormuz not because I'm special or because I've killed Iranian people. It's because I went there in peace. They can do the same if they really want access to the Iranian economy or Iranian history or geography. They don't need to fly in on bombers or fighter jets or sneak in the dead of night or bribe people suffering under sanctions to carry out attacks against infrastructure. They can just come in peace, and they could do that all over the region. And so my hope is that the American people will empathize and just see the humanity in the Iranian people. And I think a lot of them do. I'm not fooled by the polls. I think the majority of the American people are sick and tired of more war in the Middle East. They want to finally see American tax dollars go to serve the interests of the American people, revitalize the nation and the crumbling infrastructure, provide people more affordable health care, higher education, better transportation. These are all things that Iran provides for their people. Iran is a country under sanctions, and they've managed to not only, everyone talks about their missiles, they talk about their drones. Marco Rubio said, oh, life in Iran would be better if they just stopped spending on their military. Well, first of all, life in Iran is already good. And I don't want to speak on behalf of the Iranian people because obviously they have frustrations. They have reasons to criticize the government. It's not easy living under sanctions. I interviewed a woman last summer in Iran and I asked her, like, what do you want? And she said, at the end of the month, I would just like to be able to save money. And I thought about how that's like pretty much the exact same thing that the American people would like. Like, there's a reason why campaigns like Zoran Mamdani or Bernie Sanders are so popular, is because people are struggling to survive. Things are not affordable, not just in Iran under sanctions, but also in the United States, the wealthiest place, not just in the world, but in the history of the world. And so it's the same problem. But at least in Iran, you can go to college for free. You can go to the hospital for free. You can take the subway in any major city. You can take the train across the entire country. These are things I can't do in Florida. So in many ways, if you compare the metrics, people in Iran actually have a very good life. And so I hope Americans understand that, and that we can have it for ourselves in America as well, if the government would just prioritize the interests of the people.
Ahmed, we're so grateful to you for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me. Love the work that you do. And obviously, I encourage my audience as well to always check out Electronic Intifada. And so much of my work is only made possible by the work that you guys do. And not just now, but, you know, I was an activist in college, and all we did was constantly cite the Electronic Intifada. And so thank you all for the work that you do. And, you know, what I do is impossible without your contribution. So thank you.
Thanks, Ahmed. That was filmmaker Ahmed Hussein, founder of the media project Propaganda & Co. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
When I was a child, Timonides, I had a secret fear that night would come and would never end. That we would live out our lives in total darkness. It was a small fear then.
Dark Side of the Tune has returned, and now at an even darker time spot. Tune in on Thursdays at 9 p.m. to get your dose of alternative music, including, but not limited to, metal, grunge, goth, and more.